I'm Dr. Mark Rowe, and welcome to my podcast, In the Doctor's Chair. As a family physician, my expertise is supporting people in the areas of positive health and lifestyle medicine. Join me in conversations that share life lessons, health habits, and leadership practices, focusing on positive psychology, lifestyle medicine, and ways that enable you to live with more vitality on purpose. Appreciating that when it comes to your vitality, that everything is so interconnected. Episodes will air weekly, and you can find me wherever you listen to your podcasts, and of course, on my website, drmarkrowe.com. I'm delighted to be joined in the doctor's chair today by Kieran O'Boyle. Kieran O'Boyle is a pioneering leader and professor in the area of psychology, leadership, and positive health. He established the first ever department of psychology in an Irish medical school back in 1985. Currently, as professor of psychology at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, he is the founding director of the RCSI's Centre for Positive Health Sciences, formerly known as the Centre for Positive Psychology and Health. As an author, he has published 3 books, contributed to numerous book chapters, and more than 100 peer-reviewed papers. In addition, Kieran has extensive experience as a consultant psychologist for a range of national and international public and private sector organizations. Kieran, it's great to have you in the doctor's chair.
Thanks for inviting me, Mark. I love the podcast, so it's a real honor to be here. Thank you.
Pleasure is all mine. I want to start, Kieran, by looking back to your childhood. I believe your father was a teacher. Is that right?
Both my parents were teachers. We had an unusual childhood. There were 7 of us in the family, Mark, and we grew up in a little place called Wooden Bridge, most of us, and then family moved to Arklow. But my parents were primary school teachers in a 2-teacher school up a mountain near Avoca. And all 7 of us went through that school. So we owed our parents a great deal more than many people owe their parents. But it's somewhat unusual to have been given your early education by both your parents.
It certainly is. I can't even imagine what that must have been like. But I really want to ask you about, I know your father was a very hard worker, very dedicated. The teachers back there, it was really a vocation, I think, in those days. I'm not saying it isn't now, but certainly it always was back then. And you told me a very poignant story recently when we met in person about your dad and his plans for his retirement. Would you like to share that with our listeners, Kieran?
Yeah, it was a lesson to us all in my family. My father taught for 40 years. He came from 7 generations of school teachers. They could trace their lineage back to the Hedge Schools in Donegal. A remarkable man, very gentle sort of man, very dedicated to education. Back then, he was reading books like Teilhard de Chardin, The Phenomenon of Man. So he's very, very interesting man. So having taught for 40 years, he retired then. And the day he collected his gratuity check from the Department of Education, that was the day he was killed in a car crash. And it just came completely out of the blue. 1983, he was 65 years of age. So, you know, he never got any time to experience retirement. And while he was a great teacher in life, in some ways, you know, there was a lesson for us all in his death as well, because I remember when we went, myself and my brother, Senan, we went to collect his body in the morgue. You know, and collecting his you know, artifacts and his watch and his ring and so on. Among his artifacts were the check that he had got from the Department of Education. And it was covered in his blood. Now, that's a very strong image. It stayed with me for the last 45 years. But in that, the lesson really for us all, I think, is, hey, money doesn't really matter. You know, up to a certain point, of course it does. But after that, it doesn't. And the second thing, more importantly, I think, is this idea of carpe diem. You just have no idea when life ends, and it can go in an absolute instant, as it did in my father's case. So the lesson really is live your life. It's not a rehearsal. You don't get two cracks at it. You know, you get one life and live it. That's the message that I took from that. Clearly for us, it was incredibly traumatic and very, very difficult. And I'll often say to people who talk to me about grief, you know, I'll say, I think about my father every day, still, that he's still with me. So I don't think grief is something, you don't get over the person, you don't get over the death. I think you learn to live with it, and it builds into your sense of self. But I think about my father still to this day, and I'm in my late 60s now.
And my dad died many years ago, and I'm the same. I mean, an analogy I often use with patients, Kieran, is if you think of your life as being like a jigsaw, it's like there's a big piece missing when someone close to you dies, and you can never replace that missing piece in the jigsaw. But you, over time, you learn to adapt and adjust and cope as best you can. But they're still there.
I think for me, that's what afterlife actually means. I often say to people as well that I did a lot of work with the Hospice Foundation. I've always been interested in palliative care, going back 25, 30 years. But I'll often say to people, the other thing that changes when somebody dies, and the jigsaw is a very good analogy for that, is that a family is a system. And when you remove one big part of the system, every single other part of it has to change. All relationships change for the system to find an equilibrium again. And I think that sometimes comes as a surprise to people, that all relationships within the family shift, and family then kind of settles back into a different equilibrium. And of course, it can take a very long time.
That must have been a very traumatic experience for you as a young man, and for your entire family. Do you think that's where your interest in philosophy and positive psychology came from, to an extent?
Not so much. I was always interested in psychology. In fact, I went to university to do physics. I went to become a scientist and discovered psychology and philosophy when I was there, and went off on that track. But I did psychology as a scientist in those days. Mm. That was the approach. I think it's only in later years I came across positive psychology. It came about because we'd set up an Institute of Leadership in RCSI in 2005, and I was running that, and we were training health professionals in leadership and management, because most of us don't get any development or any training in that. So we were running master's programs in leadership and management and so on. And I started reading about how we create positive organizations. Mm. And that brought me to a lot of very good research in the University of Michigan on ways in which a certain type of leadership and management can be used to create organizations in which people absolutely thrive. And that piqued my interest. So we started teaching some of that on the programs. And that led me back around then, a bit further back into the emergence of positive psychology, particularly in the last 20 to 25 years. This idea that psychology had emerged really, psychology emerged from philosophy and physiology. And it became a science, but became a dismal science, a bit like economics. You know, it learned a great deal about, we knew a great deal about stress and anxiety and depression. And Marty Seligman and a few other people at that time said, we know nothing much about the upside of the human condition, joy and gratitude and love and strengths and so on. So you try to balance out psychology by creating positive psychology, which is this orientation that said, what's the science of that? Can we have a science of the positive side of human nature? And that's really what brought me back around into positive psychology. And eventually that led to us setting up this center for positive health sciences.
Brilliant. And, you know, this idea of, you know, what's strong as opposed to what's wrong, and how you can thrive as to merely survive. It's a brilliant way of looking at life through the lens of possibility, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I go back very often, my touchstone is one of my touchstones, and we may talk about it later, is the Stoic philosophers. Mm-hmm. But my touchstone for a very long time has been Viktor Frankl, and a book which I'm sure you'll know, Mark, A Man's Search for Meaning. I just keep going back to it because I think a great deal of modern psychology, particularly in the areas of post-traumatic growth, resilience, positive psychology itself, whole psychology of meaning, goes back to Frankl. That book his experience in the concentration camps, the fact he was a psychiatrist going in, he was only 26 years of age. And he comes out of that and he writes this incredible book in which he says the Nazis could take his liberty, but they couldn't take his freedom to choose his response to what was happening to him. And there's so much in that adversity. We're all going to face adversity in our lives. The question is, what do we do with that? How do we respond to that? There's so much value in that one idea that Frankl, I think, articulated it brilliantly. And he had the experience. I mean, his mother, his father, his wife, they were all murdered as soon as they went into the concentration camp. So there are touchstones like that back along the way, I think, that are incredibly important.
I agree with you, Kieran. I think Man's Search for Meaning by Frankl is a beautiful book, a wonderful book, full of meaning, full of depth, full of wisdom. I remember he said at one stage, that which provides light must endure burning. The idea that, as you said, we all face struggles and setbacks. And I suppose that's one of the really key ideas, isn't it, about positive psychology, that it's not about being positive all the time. It's not this delusional idea of permanent happiness.
Yes, indeed. And in some ways, the term positive psychology may not be the best term, because the first wave of positive psychology, as you'll know, focused very much only on the positive. And, you know, it came in for a lot of criticism because it seemed to be saying, well, we shouldn't have negative experiences, and negative experiences are deleterious, and not a bit of it. So the second wave really was to say, yes, we're focused on thriving and flourishing and so on. But part of the way into that is through adversity. So when we have negative experiences, it's not supposed to be that we're supposed to be all happy and clappy or any of that. I mean, the real core is, I suppose, Marty Seligman's model would say, well, yeah, positive emotions are part of it, but so is accomplishment, so is meaning. So relationships are incredibly important, some sense of mastery there. It's quite a complex mix that leads to happiness. And that goes back, of course, to Aristotle, this idea of eudaimonia, that, you know, happiness is really about meaning. It's not about happy, clappy feelings. It's about having a sense of meaning and a sense of mastery and something that gives you fulfillment. That's what happiness is about. And in the modern era, there's often this confusion with Hollywood and, you know, the sort of hedonistic culture that happiness is about feeling good and that's it. And of course, it's a part of it, but that's a very small part of what we mean when we talk about happiness in the context of positive psychology.
I love what Martin Seligman said, that we can't change the experience in life, but we can change the explanation. And that brings me into this whole idea of the Stoic philosophers, which I know you're a big fan of, Kieran.
Yeah, I used to be interested in the Stoics way back when I was in college, but I came back around to them at the start of COVID. And I think the COVID pandemic, and you'll know this from your clinical practice better than I think COVID has been very difficult for people. I think at the time it was really about the physical, the infection, the virus and all of that. But I think for very many people, COVID has had, there's a second epidemic, and that's a mental health epidemic. And I think there are many people fatigued, people suffering from long COVID. We're not quite sure yet what that means for mental health and so on. So I came back around. I was writing a lot for clinicians at the time about dealing with this when it was very florid and very difficult for people in hospitals. I mean, the heroism of your profession, the nursing profession, just amazing what people were dealing with there. But the idea of the Stoics, the core idea of the Stoics was the notion from Marcus Aurelius, the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, that one of the core ideas, and it's core idea for me, is that the obstacle becomes the way. You know, the adversity, whatever is the obstacle, it's not that you go through the obstacle or around the obstacle itself becomes the way. So I think those kinds of threats to our well-being, to our health, to our sanity, the obstacle, the block itself becomes the way. And I think that transforms the meaning of that. Also, I was very interested in Epictetus.
Yes.
One of the other Stoic philosophers. Again, that notion that you control what you can and don't worry too much about the rest of it. Now, Covey, in his book, which I think everybody should read, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, that idea that Covey has, and I think it's the fourth habit, that idea of control and influence. I mean, a lot of this stuff goes right back to the Stoics. They were way, way, way ahead. We are often kind of putting old wine in new bottles. So it's remarkable. The most remarkable book for me in that canon is really Marcus Aurelius, the fact that these were notes that he made for himself. He never expected it to be published. In fact, he instructed that it shouldn't be, but it should be destroyed when he died. But here's an emperor writing these very humble notes to himself about how to get through the day, how to deal with people. And ironically enough, he was dealing with a plague in Rome when he was emperor at the same time. So the Stoic philosophers, for anybody interested in that, I think Massimo Pigliucci's book, How to Be a Stoic, is a great introduction to that. Ryan Holiday, of course, everybody will, anyone interested in this will know about, but Pigliucci in particular is a very nice introduction to Stoicism.
And I really think you're so right. There's so much wisdom in the Stoic philosophy and their approach to, you know, accepting things as they are, staying humble, staying grateful, and as you say, making the obstacle the way. In other words, leaning into life's challenges and embracing it.
And they had another very interesting idea, which was called the premeditatio malorum. And this was the idea that when you're thinking about, you know, things coming up, that you do think sometimes about the worst thing that can happen. And that means you're starting mentally to prepare for it. Now, it might not happen, but if it does, at least you've done some mental preparation for it. So there's a lot of very solid techniques that the Stoics talked about. And the Buddhists, of course, would have them. I mean, there's a philosophy that's still over 2,500 years old. Similar sorts of ideas there that kind of come back around to us and then get dressed in new clothes. And we call them psychology or, you know, well-being or something like that.
Kieran, you're clearly a very wise, very well-read, very learned man. Looking back, you know, what advice would you give to that version of you in your early 20s? You just lost your dad. You're just starting out in life yourself.
I think, well, I was 26 when I lost my father. I think if I went back a little bit further than that, when I was in my early 20s, I was very curious. I think I was very intellectual. And I think my advice to myself would be, don't be so intellectual. Don't be so one-tracked. You know, broaden out your development. Pay much more attention to emotions, to relationships and so on. So that would be one piece of advice. I think I was kind of a bit unidimensional when I was in my 20s. I would also advise myself to not worry too much. Things broadly work out. you can worry away. There's an awful lot of energy and time spent worrying about the future, where in fact, mostly the future works out pretty okay, you know. So that would be a piece of advice. And the other piece of advice I'd probably give myself, which is based on a very nice study that Peter Gillam did in the RCSI, we interviewed 350 consultant doctors and surgeons who very established people in their careers in their 50s and 60s. And he asked them that question, what would you say to your 21-year-old self? And about 65% of them would say, you know, balance out your life. Don't spend all your life working. Just get the work-life balance right. I think I worked very hard for a long period of my life. I don't regret that. But I think if I were doing it again, I'd probably try to have a bit more balance there and not put so much emphasis on A, work, and B, intellectual kind of pursuits, you know.
Appreciate as well, perhaps, that life is a marathon and not to be in such a rush, maybe.
It's not a sprint, absolutely.
It's not a sprint. And looking forward, Kieran, you know, over the next 5 to 50 years, what do you hope might be different than compared to now?
You mean for me personally?
For you, yeah, personally.
There's a couple of things, really. I'm absolutely delighted to have a granddaughter, Anna. So when you become a grandfather, that changes your perspective again. It gives a whole interesting new lease of life. So I'm looking forward to developing that relationship and watching Anna as she grows and matures. That has also brought me on then to being very interested in, you know, issues like climate change and the emergence of artificial intelligence. So intellectually, that's the area that I, 5-10 years from now, if I live that long, I would like to be able to contribute something to those debates. I'd certainly like to, you know, maintain my physical health and well-being. So I'm really interested in, both scientifically and personally, in health span, That it's not just about how long we live, but that we live with reasonable quality of life and reasonable faculty. So I'm trying to make the investment in that now in my mid 60s, so that hopefully I'll, still be A competent and be able to and mobile, when I'm older. And I've become very interested in the last year or two in Brené Brown's work, on emotional intelligence, understanding emotions. I'd say if that was one part of my makeup that I haven't developed perhaps as much as I should have, is understanding the emotions, naming the emotions, being able to kind of manage, being more emotionally intelligent is probably a good way of putting it. And other than that, I'm looking forward to enjoying it. I'm very interested in the Tilda work in Trinity that Roseanne Kenny is doing on the aging populations, where her data shows that if your mindset is, I might be this age, but I actually feel 10, 15 years younger, holding on to that actually confers 7 extra years of life. I mean, that's extraordinary. Clint Eastwood puts it very well. He says he's at 92 and he's asked about still making films, and he says he gets up every morning and he doesn't let the old man in. So yeah. I think that's a good way to go,
I think it is. And I think that your mindset about aging can have such a significant impact on how you actually do age. Just getting back to health span, Ciarán, because I think it is a fantastic term, the idea of the number of years you actually stay healthy. What are your staying healthy practices? I mean, what are you actually doing?
Well, there's a couple of things, and because we teach positive health now, and we expect our students on our master's programs and diploma programs to come up with a health plan for themselves, which they follow through the year or 2 years of the program, and our assignments are based on that health plan. So I do the similar sorts of things myself. So physical, there's no doubt that our mental health is hugely influenced by our physical health. We've tended not maybe to pay enough attention to that in psychology and psychiatry. I mean, running, for example, it seems to be a tremendous antidote to depression. Some of this new research to science is coming out is really interesting on that. So for me personally, I go to the gym a couple times a week. I run as much as I can. I'm trying to build up my running, much more careful about nutrition. And then as I move forward and move towards retirement, I'm back to thinking more about what the Japanese call ikigai, the idea of meaning and how we create and maintain meaning. So one of the challenges for me, Mark, would be when I step down from my current role, how will I maintain a meaningful existence? And I haven't quite worked that out yet, but I'll get there. But I'm not in a huge hurry about that. I think that will emerge. Probably it'll be around writing and, maybe continuing to do some lecturing. And so, but I'm quite happy, I must say, to be or to Eric Fromm's distinction, to have or to be. I'm really quite happy to be and be more in the moment. I'm very interested in the arts, particularly the visual arts. I'm very interested in film, very interested in nature. So I am looking forward to having more time for more immersion in that. And the final thing I'd love to do at some point is I'd love to teach a psychology course just using the arts. Theatre, film, the visual arts, song, opera, and so on. No textbooks, but have the science behind it, but use the arts to illustrate the psychological development and psychological functioning of the human being. So that's a project I have at the back of my mind.
Fantastic. Well, I know you have, it's obvious you've got such a love of learning and you're such a curious person. So you're clearly playing to all of your innate strengths there, which is great to hear. But you also strike me as being a grateful person, Ciarán.
Yeah, I was very fortunate. I think I'm often asked to do lectures, for example, or do sessions for government agencies or schools. I'll always do them. And we never charge that, because part of the way I see it, I got a free education in Ireland. I was educated by my parents in a primary school. That was free. But the Christian Brothers, I was educated by the Christian Brothers in Arklow. And I know that there's a huge amount of challenge to the church, and rightly so, because of what's happened. In fact, we did a major study and published a book on clerical sex abuse. But a great many of the clergy in Ireland, priests, nuns, brothers and so on, gave of their best selves. It was a small number, of course, who really did enormous damage. I'm very grateful for the education I got, the same in UCD, did my degrees in UCD and various other stuff. And then I did theology in Milltown, went back at night and did theology in Milltown. So I'm extremely grateful for having had those opportunities. Many people didn't get those opportunities. I'm very grateful to my teams, the teams I work with. You know, I've learned perhaps later in my life that leadership is really about creating the environment in which your people can thrive and to work to their best strengths. But what they give then when that's created, it's so wonderful. It makes the job of being a leader very easy. And I'm extremely grateful for that. And of course, I'm grateful, as I was saying at the top of this, I'm very grateful to my parents, because for all of us, not only did they bear us and raise us and so on, they educated us. You know, the first 10, 11 years of our lives were we were educated by our parents.
Absolutely. And I remember reading once that, you know, gratitude turns what we have into enough. And I think it is really a wonderful way to see the world, because it is a conscious choice to see that, see things through that lens of
I think
appreciation
so, yeah.
And abundance, yeah. And really, and then to give back through your everyday actions, to give back to others, to pay it forward, as sometimes they say, or spread it.
Yeah, and you make a really good point. There's a fabulous paper by Roy Burmaster, and I'm sure you're aware of it, called Bad is Stronger Than Good. And there's a lot of good research to show that human beings are hardwired to see the negative, that, you know, we're much more aware in our environments, negative events, dangers. We have more words in the English language for negative emotions. You know, we tend, when we get a feedback, to focus on that. So there's an inherent bias towards the negative. And it's probably had survival value at one point back in our early evolution. But what it means is that we have to consciously make an effort to balance out the negative. And that's where I think some of the positive psychology interventions, like keeping a gratitude journal, like writing down at the end of the day three good things that have happened today, like focusing more on the positives and the strengths of people, our own strengths. If we do that, it counters that intrinsic bias in a really, really important way. And I think that creates more equanimity in our daily lives. And if you turn on the news, I listen sometimes to the Irish news, and I listen to it sometimes abroad. You know, it's just so negative. And if there isn't a murder, RT will find one for you. You know, they'll go somewhere abroad and we'll get a report over. There's no balancing out in the media of the positive with the negative. So I think we have to be quite careful about how we consume news. And I'm putting news there in inverted commas. So I think it's a way forward in terms of improving mental health, to start to find techniques, tools, paradigms, ways of thinking that counter that intrinsic negativity that exists in our normal mindset.
You're absolutely right. I was privileged to interview Roy Baumeister on the podcast about 2 years ago. An absolutely brilliant man. And that negativity bias, that hardwired disposition for the negative. And I think you're so right. We need to be careful about all the environments that we're exposed to, because nothing occurs in isolation. Nothing occurs in a vacuum. We're constantly being tweaked and influenced by our exposures. And that really brings me on, Ciarán, to my next question in terms of resilience, building a resilient mind. Could you give at least three take homes for our listeners?
From my own experience, the things that I find work for me, and that's all I can talk about. I don't have a monopoly on knowledge here or anything like that. But for me, in terms of how I do it, I go back regularly to that idea that you know, it's our reaction to a situation is something we can control. So it's not the situation that's stressful in itself and of itself, but it's our reaction to the situation. And there's a great deal we can do to control our reaction to the situation. Alia Crum's work in Stanford shows that if we relabel stress as excitement, for example, in some circumstances, that changes the whole nature of stress. So that distinction between a situation and our reaction to it, I find that very helpful. I also find it very helpful to try to keep perspective. Because as you go through life, you see the same patterns going through again. And by and large, things work. Our time is a great sort of healer. I think sometimes we have to stand back and let things emerge sort of organically, perhaps. For me, resilience, mental resilience is tied into physical resilience. I get tired. So if I'm not careful about my energy levels, I'll find my resilience decreases. So I'm careful with that. So I think the usual things, sleep and diet and exercise, those kinds of things are important. And then the other thing I discovered, I did the course with Stephen Covey about 25 years ago, the Seven Habits course. And that idea of managing time that Covey developed, it originally came from Benjamin Franklin. The idea that you've got urgent things and you've important things, and we just can get very caught up in urgency. Whereas that, what Covey calls quadrant two, doing the things that are important but not urgent, that's where effective people operate. So sometimes that means that you're predicting, you're thinking ahead, you're kind of reflecting, you're spending time planning. And you stop doing what he called the quadrant three stuff, the stuff that's urgent but not important, all the sort of faffing around and the stuff and that comes up. So for me, a big part of resilience is managing time carefully so that I manage my energy carefully.
Brilliant. And finally, Ciarán, for you, what's the meaning of life?
Well, that's a really great question, and I'm going to quote somebody because I knew you were going to ask me this. But this is something I came across a few years ago, and I've used it at the end of some of my own lectures. It's not mine, but it completely resonates with me in terms of the meaning of life. It's Ralph Waldo Emerson, and it's his definition of success. And I'm sure you're familiar with this. So if it's okay, I'll just quote it. For Emerson, he said, "Success is to laugh often and much. To win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics and to endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, to know that even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded." That for me is the meaning of life, and I keep going back to it regularly as a sort of a touchstone. That's what it means to be successful, not the other sorts of indicators, so-called indicators of success that we're often told are important.
What a beautiful way to end our podcast conversation. I too love that Emerson quote of real success. Ciarán, keep leading, keep inspiring, keep living your own beautiful definition of success now and far into the future. Ciarán O'Boyle, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to my podcast, In the Doctor's Chair. For further resources to support you to live with more vitality, please visit my website, drmarkrowe.com.